It's called Petroleum Reserve because it's a petroleum reserve.
Alaskans debate development alternatives in NPRA. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 15th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the impending retirement of two beloved seaplanes in the Aleutians, the Gooses.
I'm not sure why that's the term, but you'll identify yourself as an amateur if you use the word geese.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Walter Bud Carpinetti of Juneau has announced his retirement effective in January. Carpinetti served for 17 years on the State Superior Court in Juneau, appointed by Governor Jay Hammond in 1981. Governor Tony Knowles appointed him to the State Supreme Court in 1998, and he was retained by voters in 2002. Alaska Supreme Court justices selected Carpinetti as Chief Justice in June of 2009. The Chief Justice serves a three-year term, and Carpinetti's ends this month. Alaska's mandatory retirement age for judges is 70. Carpinetti is 66 years old and says it seems like the right time to retire.
I kind of look at it from the other perspective. I was appointed in 1981, so I've been on the bench for over 30 years, and it just seems like it's probably the right time now to get some younger folks in with, you know, a little more vitality.
The Chief Justice says he likes aspects of both the Superior and Supreme Courts.
I loved the trial court because it's closer to the process and because you see and hear the witnesses and you work with the jurors, and it was much more immediate.
He says the best thing about the appellate process is being able to work with people in the same job.
You really learn so much about cases when you hear the different perspectives of other people. It's sometimes very difficult, the appellate process, because you're searching for agreement and you're trying to synthesize different views and find the commonality in the way we approach it. And our court tries not to have a lot of separate opinions, and you work to find common ground. And sometimes that's a difficult process, but it's also pretty exhilarating.
Carpinetti says he's giving early notice of retirement because of the lengthy procedure for filling Supreme Court vacancies. Before he was appointed to the bench, he was a member of the Alaska Judicial Council and knows the evaluation process well. His last day on the bench will be January 31st of next year. The Bureau of Land Management has hosted more than 10 public meetings this spring as part of the process to develop the first comprehensive management strategy for National Petroleum Reserve Alaska. The public comment period for the draft integrated activity plan and environmental impact statement ends today. KUAC's Emily Schwing attended a meeting in Fairbanks to find out how people are feeling about potential oil and gas development in a controversial corner of the North Slope.
At 23 million acres, the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska is the largest single unit of land managed by the Bureau of Land Management. But there's no single plan for the entire reserve. The BLM has developed four different strategies that range from a do-nothing approach to opening all acreage in the reserve to oil and gas development. During a public meeting in Fairbanks, BLM Environmental Planning Supervisor Serena Sweet spent some time answering questions and guiding people through a series of large maps depicting the four proposed alternatives.
I think it's important to recognize that none of the alternatives as they're presented today will likely move forward. It'll most likely be a combination of certain aspects and ideas and maybe even new ideas from based on what we've heard during these public meetings.
Public input helps the BLM decide what lands to make available to development and how to protect surface resources like plants and wildlife. Fairbanks resident Hugh Faint was one of the first oil workers on the North Slope, working the night shift as a driller out of Umiat in the 1950s. He told an audience of roughly 30 people that he's in favor of the most liberal plan, Alternative D.
It's called Petroleum Reserve because it's a petroleum reserve.
But NPRA is home to a vast swath of wilderness that includes at least 12 major rivers and Teshekpuk Lake, where many species of migratory birds nest, and nearby lay the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou herd. Daniel Lum grew up in Barrow, roughly 100 miles northwest of the lake. He's concerned that his subsistence lifestyle is in jeopardy, and he says he's not sure North Slope residents realize it.
They had meetings in Wainwright and Point Lay and Atkazook, all those places. We've been meeting to death. You know, with all this development going on in the last 3 years, especially offshore, I don't think people realize the vast amount of land that we're about to lose to development. I don't know anybody on the North Slope that went to these meetings. It's just another meeting. It's another meeting.
Under proposed Alternative A, the do-nothing approach, 13 million acres are available for development. The BLM estimates that land could produce roughly 723 million barrels of crude oil and 11 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Americans consumed more than 19 million barrels of refined petroleum products per day in 2010. That's according to the United States Energy Information Administration. Based on those numbers, if the BLM were to recommend even its most liberal management strategy, estimated oil production would serve the needs of the United States for about 40 days. The BLM's approved plan will also span many decades. These are all reasons why Fairbanks resident and Arctic River guide Michael Wald supports the most conservative Alternative B.
We are going to see myriad changes. Ecologically, the changes are going to be astounding, unrecognizable. I also think, and somebody else spoke to this, that the oil and gas industry is becoming increasingly good at minimizing their impacts. Both of those things lead me to the conclusion that a very conservative approach is the only appropriate thing to do when faced with that level of uncertainty.
The BLM plans to recommend a finalized management strategy for the reserve by the end of this year. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Sea Alaska land selection legislation is poised to pass the U.S. House, but the bill most likely to get through Congress appears to be in the Senate. The House version, introduced by Alaska Congressman Don Young, is among 14 measures merged into a larger bill this week. What's called the Conservation and Economic Growth Act is scheduled for floor action next week. Sea Alaska Executive Vice President Rick Harris says the Southeast Regional Native Corporation appreciates the support.
It is a bipartisan bill, and the leadership of the House has said they want to move it, and so, of course, we're not going to stand in the way of that.
Young's version has undergone some changes, but Senator Lisa Murkowski's legislation has had more revisions. Harris says Murkowski's version is more likely to succeed in both chambers of Congress as well as be acceptable to the president.
And at this point in time, it's going to take the support of all three to move that bill. So we believe that probably the Senate bill will still be the operative bill for engaging and addressing the Sea Alaska land issues.
Both versions would allow the corporation to select federal land outside boundaries set in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Corporate officials say that will keep its logging operations going, protect traditional sites, and allow for new businesses. Opponents say it's a giveaway of some of the region's most valuable lands that would hurt fisheries and subsistence. The Alaska Wilderness League is one of the bill's critics. Executive Director Cindy Shogan says the House version would do more damage than the Senate.
Both the senators from Alaska have been meeting a fair amount with their constituents and talking about their concerns, and their bills on the Senate side have modified to reflect some of those conversations.
Her group also opposes the omnibus measure before the House. Young and his spokesman could not be reached for immediate comment. Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon says the senator is still negotiating with the Forest Service. The Democratic Senate majority ends the Alaska. He says Murkowski is optimistic an agreement can be reached this summer, allowing the bill to pass out of committee. A federal judge has denied the request of several Alaska Natives to temporarily bar the state from implementing a new redistricting plan. The decision by U.S. District Judge Sharon Gleason comes one day after she heard arguments in the case. Plaintiffs have alleged the state is violating the Federal Voting Rights Act by moving ahead with election preparations under a new redistricting plan before the plan is approved by the U.S. Department of Justice. Plaintiffs sought a temporary restraining order until a three-judge panel hears the case. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth represents the complainants. Landreth says today's decision only denies the temporary restraining order and is in no way implies the courts have approved the state's current redistricting plan. Landreth says the argument regarding whether or not the division should be enjoined from implementing the redistricting plan is still headed for the three-judge panel later this month. The state's redistricting plan was submitted to the Federal Department of Justice in late May. Approval is expected in about a month. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Army National Guard investigates a mysterious plane wreck on the K'nik Glacier.
It does look like it's a vintage aircraft based on the fact that there haven't been recent accidents in that area.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
Military pilots spotted the wreckage of an aircraft on the K'nik Glacier earlier this week, and officials are considering bringing in the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, or JPAC, to conduct recovery efforts. On Sunday, Alaska Army National Guardsmen on board a UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter flying a routine training mission discovered what are being called vintage debris before they returned to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The wreck is thought to be a military aircraft, according to Alaska Command spokesman. Master Sergeant Michael Canfield with Alaska Command Public Affairs says it's not known just how old the wreck is.
It's still too early to speculate. Basically, what we were able to determine is that it does look like it's a vintage aircraft based on the fact that there haven't been recent accidents in that area from what we've been able to see on record.
Details of the find are being withheld pending possible notification of next of kin because bone fragments may be in the wreckage. Canfield says JPAC plans for an investigation are pending.
They're still evaluating to get information on their process and their procedures as far as the decision-making, the timeline.
The Federal Aviation Administration has placed a temporary flight restriction on the area due to early recovery personnel investigating the site. The case of Fairbanks militiaman Schaefer Cox and two others is one of the most compelling to hit Alaska courts in recent years. Arguments in the trial are finished, and the case has gone to the jury. Host of Alaska Edition, Michael Carey, covered the weeks-long trial and stopped by our studios with this update. He started by describing the closing arguments.
The prosecution presented their closing arguments first, and Steve Strachey led the way for the prosecution. He outlined in detail the charges, the many charges against the three defendants, the weapons charges and the conspiracy charges. He did it through a number of visuals, a PowerPoint presentation that was very vivid, very detailed, and very compelling. In response, Nelson Traverso, representing Schaefer Cox, gave a cri de coeur, a cry from the heart of this is a free speech case, and we should recognize it as such and not crucify a good American for what he's willing to say. The second defendant, Coleman Barney, was represented by Tim Dooley, and Mr. Dooley tried to point out that many of the things that Mr. Barney was accused of were not illegal acts and that many people in the jury could have done some of them themselves. And finally, Lonnie Vernon's lawyer, M.J. Hayden, emphasized that Lonnie Vernon wasn't present in a lot of these events that were so important to making the case.
Mrs. Cox did speak with reporters yesterday. Were you there?
Yes, and this was one of the most remarkable events I've been involved in Alaska journalism. Mrs. Cox, who has been through most of the trial, but not all of it, and sat in front of me for many weeks, I've wondered what she was thinking. And then this impromptu discussion with reporters as the courtroom emptied out, she gave her view of her husband, of the case against him, and of his philosophy and their background. In sort of the tabloid line that people would remember, she said what the government is doing here is creating a widow and two orphans. It was obviously she loves her husband deeply, and that motivated her statements. That was central to her statements, but it was also clear that she was a woman who really was without guile and was a lovely person caught up in something immense and far bigger than a person like she, or perhaps many people, or including myself, could ever imagine themselves winding up in.
So the jury's still out.
As we speak, the jury is still out, and they have some major decisions ahead of them, and we'll just see what happens.
How tricky is the job of the jurors now?
How tricky is the job of the jurors? Well, they are faced with a number of counts, more than a dozen, and some of them are pretty straightforward. The ones involving weapons, the machine gun and silencers and so forth, those are more or less binary. They're guilty or not guilty. The government's either shown they have these weapons, and a couple cases seem obvious they did, or not. The conspiracy charges are more difficult because you have to show that people were working together, that they knew something of what they were doing together, and you can't include an undercover informant as one of the conspirators, so it would have to be between other members than the informants.
Michael Carey is host of Alaska Edition. A slug of red salmon that moved into the Copper River at the end of May has so far largely eluded dip netters in Chitna. State biologist Mark Somerville attributes poor fishing over the last week to river conditions.
The river was extremely low, so we may have seen some of those fish moving up sooner. In Chitna this last week, in the opener, the harvests were quite a bit below expected. And we also had a rise in the river during that time period. The river came up almost 3 feet over 3 or 4 days. So that kind of rise in the river tends to slow the fish down. So we still expect to see some of these fish coming up the river. How well they're going to be caught is hard to say.
A supplemental period during which dip netters can take an additional 10 reds beyond the season limit runs through Sunday. Somerville says abundant sockeye passage at the river's mouth that prompted the supplemental harvest has dropped off. Somerville says the Copper River King Salmon Run continues to look weak. The commercial harvest on the Delta is well below average, and fish wheel sample catches near the mouth have prompted the state to close the dip net fishery to king retention as of Monday the 18th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Rachel Waldholtz. This week on AK, the goose. The Grumman Goose seaplane has served the Aleutian region for the better half of a century, shuttling residents from remote islands to Dutch Harbor. But once the new Acutan Airport is complete later this summer, water landings in the Bering Sea will be a thing of the past. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has this goodbye to the goose.
I give you guys a briefing real quick. Everybody has to wear the seat belts.
These two doors in the back are exits, the two windows up front.
Burke Meese has probably given this speech 1,000 times. He's a pilot for Penn Air, and today he's taking me and six others up in the Grumman Goose for a flight sing tour of Unalaska. If all goes as planned with the construction of the Akutan Airport, this will be one of his last trips on the Goose. But it's my first, and I feel like a big, excited kid when I settle into the co-pilot's chair.
Okay, y'all buckled in there?
I am.
Burke revs up the twin engines, and the hula girl on the dashboard begins to wobble. The plane lurches forward along the runway, crosses a major city road, and suddenly we're not in the air, but in the water. There are no skis, so the deep fuselage is slicing through the bay. We take off from there. Burke tells me after the flight that some passengers are surprised when the plane hits the waves.
It used to happen just kind of on a regular basis, usually like a state bureaucrat from Fairbanks or something going to the villages, and they walk across the ramp and get in the airplane and it flies for a little while, and then next thing you know, the airplane is slamming into these big waves and got spray past the windows and water washing up over the bow, and I can always tell that person because I hear him screaming in the back.
Usually they're no worse for wear.
I always say they're a better person for the experience. They go home with being a better person for that.
Burke enjoys initiating people into the ways of the Goose. For example, he lets me know that the plane's plural is actually gooses.
I'm not sure why that's the term, but you'll identify yourself as an amateur if you use the word geese.
He also teaches me about the Goose's rich history. Burke says the plane was first built in the 1930s to be used as a civilian aircraft.
Its original intent was to fly people from Long Island to Manhattan, to fly businessmen.
The Gooses were supposed to be luxury planes, with wet bars and the modern indulgence of a toilet. But World War II got in the way of that. Because the planes were so good at handling water and land, the Navy and Coast Guard started using them for military transport. So did Britain's Royal Air Force. By the time the war was over, about 345 Gooses had been built. The planes went on to be flown commercially in British Columbia, California, and the Caribbean. They were also used across Alaska by passenger airlines, remote hunting lodges, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service staff.
You'd still make people nervous by flying over them, and those are airplanes.
The Goose has a lot of local history, too, Burke says. Couples have gotten married on it. Singer Jimmy Buffett once came up to fly it, and Santa Claus uses it each Christmas to deliver gifts to the children in the villages.
I used to say that Santa Claus, while he flies his own sled around, he prefers to have the professionals take him around in the illusions.
Now there are only about 30 Gooses left that are airworthy, with many of them in private ownership. Once Penn Air retires its two planes, there won't be any passenger airlines offering scheduled Goose service in the United States. Over a phone call, Penn Air President Danny Siebert tells me that he already put one up for sale, and that I can have it for $350,000. But on a reporter's salary, it's not in my budget. It seems like a museum should buy it, or some deep-pocketed aviation enthusiast who can baby it. After all, it's easy to fall in love with. Burke says that, like most old planes, it's got plenty of personality.
It's a tough and graceful airplane.
Would you be friends with the Goose if it were a human in real life?
I already am friends with the Goose.
And Burke's friends are friends with the Goose, too. One night this winter, he and an Alaska resident, Sharon O'Malley, were mourning the impending loss of the Goose and decided that, like most great things, it deserves a song. And so they wrote one. In the ballad, Sharon sings that the Goose may cost too much to run these days and that it will soon be a relic of a day gone by. But when it goes, it will be bittersweet. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
She was part of the landscape here. She did her job here after. Time has come, the end is near. The Goose, she is a jewel in the sky. 'Cause she goes places that the others wouldn't dare to try. But soon she'll be a relic of a day gone by.
You can hear the full version of Sharon O'Malley's song and watch video of the Goose at alaskapublic.org. Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to another island community, Petersburg in southeast Alaska.
My name is Sally Norheim-Dwyer, and I am
the manager, executive director of the Chamber of Commerce and the Visitor Center. I'm also the wife of the mayor. Petersburg is an island, on an island called Mitkoff, and we're nestled in amongst the icebergs and the glaciers of Frederick Sound. It's a lovely spot. We're surrounded by huge, tall mountains. We're in a fjord. Peter Bushman founded our community in 1897. He came up for the ice, and he discovered there was so much fish here that the next year he brought his son up, and they made a settlement and started a community, which then people wrote home to Norway and said, oh, you need to come. We've got a new little town going. There's lots of fish. And the Norwegians just flocked to the area. Petersburg chose many years ago not to build a deep water port so that the big cruise ships could come in here. We determined that we were a working fishing town and we didn't want to reinvent ourselves for the 3 months a year that you would have 10 or 12,000 people a day visiting your community. So we've kept things pretty personal. We do parades at the drop of a hat. We have a wonderfulness parade that people walk their dogs and cats down the street dressed in funny costumes. We celebrate Norwegian Constitution Day every year for 4 days. We have our little Norway festival, and everybody is a Norwegian by honor for that weekend. We get lots of rain here, and a lot of people might think rain is a bad thing, but we love it. It keeps our skin fresh and our youthful look to all the women in town. We don't worry about all the motions and potions. We just enjoy being hydrated naturally in Petersburg.
That was Sally Norheim Dwyer, Executive Director of the Petersburg Chamber of Commerce. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Alexandra Gutierrez, Wendy Jonathan, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander, Casey Kelly, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Emily Schwing and Dan Ross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.